Now, turn over and look at Part B. Part B, questions 25 to 30. In this part of the test, you'll hear six different extracts. In each extract, you'll hear people talking in a different healthcare setting. For questions 25 to 30, choose the answer A, B, or C, which fits best according to what you hear. Now look at question 25. Now, read the question.
The new draft recommendations make 3 points. The first point is that WHO recommends a reduced intake of free sugars throughout the life course. The second recommendation is that the intake of free sugars in both adults and children should not exceed 10% of total energy intake. But we also make a third recommendation, and that is that a further reduction to less than 5% of total energy gives additional health benefits. We know that dietary risk factors are very important factors for the risk of non-communicable disease. We have an epidemic of non-communicable diseases. We have at the moment 36 million people dying from non-communicable diseases, most of them in the developing world, 80%. We have a projection of 50 million for 2030, so it's huge. And dietary risk factors, as well as tobacco, are one of the main determinants of those diseases. I mean, if you remove the risk factors, then a lot of those deaths can be preventable.
Question 26. Now, read the question.
Overall, what we found were some very reassuring things for physicians caring for women with epilepsy and for women with epilepsy who are planning to become pregnant. Because what we found is, counter to previous dogma, I think, women with epilepsy are not at a substantially increased risk of having to have a C-section during their delivery, late pregnancy bleeding, or premature contractions or delivery. Also, the findings strongly support that if a woman is seizure-free for a period of time, 9 months to 1 year prior to becoming pregnant, it's very likely that she will continue to remain seizure-free throughout the pregnancy. So this is very reassuring information to women and their physicians as they plan going ahead with pregnancy.
Question 27. Now read the question.
Opioids like codeine have very limited evidence in the management of chronic persistent pain. I think our role in the pharmacy is to have the conversation with patients to help them understand the biopsychosocial model of chronic pain and to shift their expectations towards improving their function rather than expecting a cure of their pain. We also need to refer these patients to a GP for a comprehensive assessment.
Annoyed customer. This will take more time out of our busy schedules and more money out of our pockets on pain relief thanks to those who abuse it.
It's important to help consumers understand that codeine is a highly addictive drug. We know that tolerance, dependence, and addiction to codeine can develop very quickly, and that many people are self-diagnosing and self-treating with codeine combination products available over the counter. I think it's important that we can reassure patients that there are alternatives available in the pharmacy, and that if they do need codeine-containing products, that they can still get them on prescription from their GP.
Question 28. Now read the question.
The aged care channel for me takes a lot of the pressure off having to research, find out information. The staff are accepting of it, so it's just another tool, another resource that we use very often. And I'd have to say they embrace it because it's something they can go and do on their own, but it's also something we can do as a group. The aged care channel is pivotal in our training and development resources. It's something that we use all the time. It's part of induction, it's part of ongoing education, it helps registered nurses with their ongoing professional learning. We couldn't do without it. Oh, the aged care channel is a great part of our training and developing resource. It's the biggest part. We certainly have libraries, lending libraries in each facility. As I said, it's part of the induction progress, so it's pivotal. We couldn't do without it. The channel to me is a different tool. We don't have the equipment or the skills to make DVDs or live television, so it brings another type of learning, because everyone learns differently, right into rooms right across the villages. So for us, it's a different method, and a lot of the staff really respond to that rather than someone just talking at them. So the interaction, the acting, the scenario, all adds to the learning.
Question 29. Now read the question.
The idea here is to take those cells out of her body or patients' bodies and reprogram them. That's the term for gene editing. Reprogram those cells to identify cancer, put them back into the body in much larger quantities so that the army has expanded, and then see if that can fight the cancer. It's been an early story over the last couple of years, but the early results are quite promising in leukemia and lymphoma. We've seen it a couple of years ago in melanoma, and studies are now getting started in other cancers like ovarian cancer, breast cancer, pancreatic cancer. Very exciting story. We, at our center in Nashville, just 6 days ago, opened a trial in the community for patients with lymphoma. So very exciting time. Well, we've always known that there's a genetic link to a number of cancers. The big struggle is identifying whether a particular genetic abnormality in an individual, say, at an early point in their life, is going to lead to the development of cancer. So we know for several cancers there's a high risk with certain genes. I guess the one that has caught a lot of attention over the last several years has been what's called the BRCA or BRCA genetic alterations that lead to an increased risk for breast cancer and ovarian cancer. So understanding more correlations like that, if you have this genetic abnormality at birth or later in life, is that going to lead to the development of cancer? A lot of work still in that area. We're learning it's a combination of those genetic risks and probably environmental risks as well. So it may not just be one thing that leads to the development of cancer for the majority of people.
Question 30. Now read the question.
All right, so Mrs. Smith is a 68-year-old lady. She was admitted 3 days ago with an exacerbation of a CMPD. She had a 4-day history of increasing shortness of breath on exertion, not relieved by her puffers. She has no comorbidities and no infection control precautions. She stopped smoking after her first admission about 2 years ago, and she lives at home alone with support from a daughter. She's on IV antibiotics, bronchodilators and steroids, and she's on 2 liters of oxygen via the nasal prongs. She has all the calling criteria for oxygen saturations, The target range is 88 to 92% because she retains CO2. Mrs. Smith's other vital signs are between the flags, and she needs QID obs and had some spirometry done yesterday, which the team are going to review today. She reports having a fall at home about a month ago, but she's otherwise independent with her ADLs. Falls risk was low, but I use the override option to make her a high falls risk because of her recent falls history. She's been assessed by the physio and she's on a rollator frame for it to ambulate. Her water load score is 10 and her skin integrity is intact, and she's responded well to all treatment and she's on a normal diet.
That is the end of Part B.